Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves, the co-host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino. That's Sunday mornings at 7. When I think about you, Elise, I often think about, okay, she's going to talk about real estate or the markets, but you're also thinking about automobiles these days, right?
I am. It's sort of interesting. And certainly we can talk about how, you know, interest rates fell briefly last week and there was a flurry of activity and then they went back up again. But really, when you think about cars, there's another huge piece of the economy that's kind of slowing down. One of the reasons is that new cars are really too expensive now for the average person to afford. Have you looked at any new car costs lately?
No.
So we went out last year to buy a new car for my mom, who was, if she paid for it, we didn't pay for her car, but she needed us to go do some scouting around. And I said to my husband, Sam, I was really, really surprised because we are the kind of people, we buy new cars, we keep them for 10, 15 years. My son, Michael, is driving our old car. It's almost 20 years old. We don't drive very much, right? So we keep our cars. But new cars, boy, have taken a big jump up. And so when you look at the costs of vehicles, they kind of range now an average of over $40,000 for a typical car. That is pretty darn expensive and far more expensive than the average person can afford.
And is that a car like pickup trucks, SUVs, I think are probably pushing that even higher?
Well, you know, that's part of it. Part of it is that the chip shortage, which started with the pandemic when China shut down its chip factories and really has not yet fully recovered. And you can see this because you drive by different new car lots and they're not full. They're still not full. They're more full than they used to be, but they're still not full. And so what car manufacturers did is they took a look at the inventory and the types of cars they were making, and they said, well, we could make cheap cars with the limited chips we have or make expensive cars where we make more money. Let's make the more expensive cars. And so they started to discontinue less expensive models for the more expensive models, and that's just pushed everything up. And then on top of that, of course, you've got higher interest rates, which is really boosting the cost for people.
I guess I don't blame the car manufacturers for doing that. I get that point. A chart you sent us shows then the average age as a result, right?
Well, sure, because if you're going to, if you can't afford to buy a new car or even a used car, because we've had a used car shortage pushing those prices up, you're going to try and keep your car longer. And so in 2018, the typical car was about 11.7 years old. That's the car that's on the road today. Today it's over 12 years. It's almost a full year older. And while that doesn't seem like a lot, 12-year-old cars need typically a serious amount of work. So as I said earlier, you know, we keep our cars, you know, an average of 12 to 15 years in our family. My current car right now is 10 years old, and we just had to spend $2,000 to replace, I don't know, something that went wrong with it, but you couldn't drive the car without it. So it was like that, or we buy a new car for $48,000.
At least I would like to think that something that costs you $2,000, you would know what it is, but it's just something that the car needed to go. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm telling you it was a couple of different pieces, including one of the belts that just wore out.
And by the way, I know nothing about cars, so I'm not going to tease you for not knowing what
No, it's was a fair point. I've just
thought $2,000.
Yeah.
What about electrical vehicles? Are they pushing the price up or down, or the age would be going down with electrical vehicles?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Electric vehicles are pushing ahead. And to some people, they talk about how these are going to be cars you can keep forever. We've got some good friends who own some electric vehicles, and they assure us that the batteries are going to last. That was the problem early on with electric vehicles, is that the batteries had to be replaced. And when you did, that alone would cost you somewhere between $6,000 and $10,000. So the batteries have a longer life today, and they seem to have a better way of doing it. That said, you know, electric vehicles are going to have their own problems as well, and the costs there are going up. So we saw that the Chevy Bolt announcement, I think in the last couple of weeks, that they're going to cut back on the Chevy Volt. Bolt, excuse me, and that is one of the most affordable EVs in the U.S. That's going to be discontinued at the end of the year. In 2017, there were 11 models in the U.S. available for less than $20,000. And by the end of last year, there were just four. And by March of this year, there were just two. And so if you can't afford the average price of a new car, which is $48,000, that's up 30% from before the pandemic. You're kind of out of luck. It's a big problem.
Excuse me, you were describing the declining numbers of electrical vehicles under a certain price point? Was that what
correct.
That was? Yeah.
Correct, if I wasn't clear about that. Just in terms of the cost of a cheap EV, which yeah. people want to move there, right? Because then you save them gas. But those prices are going up as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the market right now for real estate and where interest rates have gone. You said there was a little bit of a dip and people reacted last week. Is that right?
Yeah, it just dipped slightly and then it popped back up, you know, about over the last 10 days. And you saw it immediately in the number of people pulling a purchase application. So people are now sensitive to exactly what's happening on the day-to-day movement of mortgage interest rates. Today, mortgage interest rates, if you have a 700 credit score, which is the average in this country, you'll pay about 7.1% on average for a 30-year fixed rate loan in the state of Illinois. If you have an 800 credit score, right, or a perfect credit score, you'll pay about 6.5%. So there's a really big difference between credit scores. It pays to pay attention to it, I think.
Is it a good time to sell or buy then? What's the math on that?
Yeah, so Fannie Mae released its new home purchase sentiment index today, and it looks like more people are now thinking that it's a good time to buy a home. About 23% of Americans think that. And about 62% of Americans think it's a good time to sell. Selling is actually even more important right now than buying because there is such a limited number of homes in the marketplace. And in fact, another study I saw over the weekend pointed to the Chicago suburbs as being the 10th hardest place to find a home to buy right now, that the demand is so far outstripping supply. It's actually one of the few times Chicago ranks in a good way in housing. You know, typically we're always sort of at the back of it mm-hmm. or middle of it, but this time we're in the top 10 just because there's simply not enough inventory out there. So the fact that a few more people think it's a good time to sell means they might consider it and they might put their houses on the market.
And to that point, then, expectations are sometimes as important as the reality of the moment. And people think home prices are going to go which way?
Yeah, so people think that home prices will go up. About 37% of people think that. So that's a little bit more. But about a third of people think it's going to stay where they are or go down a little bit. And so I think what we're seeing is that overall, net-net, people think about 5% more of us think that prices are going to go up. That's actually what the experts are saying too, John. You know, when you talk to housing economists, they just simply say that, you know, even though interest rates are very high, the Fed has been watching for home prices to go down, and they're pretty much not going down the way that they normally would. And that, again, is because of short inventory.
Sure. They don't control the supply side of any of these things. Well, talk to me about job losses right now. What's the latest on that front?
You know, basically, we had a bang-up jobs growth last month, and those numbers came out at the end of last week. I think everybody was surprised. ADP said that the number was going to be well into the 200,000 of jobs created. Sure enough, that was where the actual number came in at the end of the week. 200 and something like 50,000 or 280,000 jobs created on a net basis. That was great news for the fact that the economy is going along, not so great for the Fed. So even though it looks like they're going to pause for a little bit, increasing interest rates, they really do want to see, you know, the jobs number continue to moderate, and they want to see home prices to come down. And so far, neither of those two things are happening. It's kind of extraordinary.
Steve Alexander talked about this briefly earlier. Warren Buffett said what? What's your reporting on that?
Well, he said at his meeting in Omaha that the extraordinary period of excessive spending on the back of the pandemic stimulus is over. And what he's seeing is that many, you know, Warren Buffett owns, I don't know how many different businesses, but they have built up inventory and they need to get rid of it. So it's clearly he's not in the car business because he could get rid of those. But the other kinds of inventory that he's built up, they're going to have sales, which means that their revenue could potentially go down and that it's a very different climate. So they've got too much inventory. It's a little bit like what happened earlier this year with Target. We saw, middle of last year, Target and Walmart both said, we've got too much stuff. We're going to have to put it on sale and get rid of it. And I think we're hearing from Warren Buffett that his companies are in the same place.
Trying to figure out if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Good for the consumer, bad for the store.
I think that's, you know, not so great for businesses, right? It could mean that profits aren't going to go up. On the other hand, if they get rid of inventory, they save money and they get more cash into the business. They can buy new things that other people are going to want. But it's a different frame of reference. It's really just a different place that we're getting to. And I think that people look to Warren Buffett for that voice of experience. Charlie Munger, his partner and the chairman of the board, co-chairman of the board, who's 99 years old and still working,
wow.
John.
Really? How old is Warren Buffett, too? I think I heard that number today.
He's 87, maybe?
Yeah, sounds about 87. Right. 87, yeah, and Munger is 90.
99. And they're sort of the voice of this, you know?
92 for Mr. Buffett.
Buffett's 92.
And Munger's 99. Mm-hmm. Almost 200 years of wisdom right there. Wow. Wow. Wow.
You know, the price of their stock has just gone up so much. It's really kind of amazing. They don't believe in splitting shares. And so I think a price, Steve's going to hold me to the line on this. I think a price of a single share of Warren Buffett's company is somewhere around $496,000. Is that right, Steve? I bet it's close to it, if not, not
I've
right.
I've heard some outrageous number like that. I've heard that, yes.
Yeah, crazy. So if you want to buy a share, you have to buy the tracking stock, which I think is, I don't know where that is, but less than $496,000
a share. Yeah, no kidding. Right. Now you're talking something I can relate to. Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media. Listen for her with our friend Tom Fortino this week in, Sunday mornings. It's 7 a.m. Okay, nice to hear you, Elise. Thanks for your help today.
You bet, John.
Let's say hello to Jim Dahlke on the Wintrust Business Lunch, national editor at American Inno. Hey, Jim, you're back on the air. How are you today?
Hey, John, good. Thanks for having me.
I am looking at some of the stories, and one of them is the amount of money that the median wage is for technology workers in Chicago. $92,000. That sounds like a good wage to me.
That's right. This is new data from a tech group called CompTIA. They regularly put out lots of great data on sort of the state of tech employment really across the country. And $92,000 for the median wage for a tech worker in Chicago. It's about 100% higher than the median wage for all other jobs in the metro region. So really, it's kind of an example of why. Tech jobs are so important to cities, especially emerging tech hubs. These are high-paying jobs. These are highly sought-after jobs, and the kinds of jobs that are really important to the economic growth of a city. There's some other interesting data in here too. Tech employment in the Chicago area grew about 1.4% from 2021 to 2022. So, hey, nice to see a little bit of growth there, but that's still kind of behind where some other Midwest cities are. Indianapolis was higher than that. Kansas City, higher than that as well. The thing about Chicago, it's a growing tech city. Obviously, it's the third largest city in the country. However, it makes up just the ninth biggest in terms of overall tech employment. So cities like Washington, D.C., Seattle, even Dallas have an overall higher number of tech jobs in the city compared to Chicago. So Chicago, of course, a very diversified city in terms of, the different business sectors, but, many in the startup ecosystem and the tech sector certainly want to see even more growth for Chicago.
Is it clear why we lag a Kansas City or someplace like that?
Well, Well, you know, you're lagging it there for growth, right? So smaller cities are going to be able to see more growth just by the sense of having kind of a smaller pool, right? So they're going to be able to grow a little bit faster when you have those kind of smaller cities, especially as, you know, the sort of COVID work from home environments are changed where you have to work, right? And so, you know, people can work for, you know, a big major tech company and live in Kansas City and Indianapolis easier today than you could have, you know, 5-10 years ago. So I think that certainly benefited a lot of kind of growing cities, is allowing growing tech cities, allowing folks to kind of work from anywhere.
You guys have a story about something called Deep Walk. What's that?
Yeah, this is a really interesting new Chicago startup. So Deep Walk is a startup actually born out of Champaign, just relocated here to Chicago, and they have created an app that allows you know, folks in the city, city engineers, to scan sidewalks and curb ramps for ADA accessibility. So kind of measuring, you know, if different walkways or, you know, American with Disabilities Act compliant for wheelchairs to get through. Kind of really interesting new product. They just raised about $1.4 million in new financing to help continue to grow their app. And so, you know, they've performed about 3,000 sidewalk accessibility inspections in downstate cities like Danville and Peoria. And so this is a, you know, a real kind of game changer for this profession, right? You know, these city engineers have to do those little wheel measuring sticks right now to kind of get a sense for if, hey, if these walkways are ADA accessible. And really what this app is able to do is kind of instantly identify, you know, the areas that are of potential concern and kind of help plan the next steps. So it's really taking a very, very manual process and bringing a very needed tech upgrade to it. So, yeah, this is an interesting startup here in Chicago. And, hey, you know, relocated to the city now here, moving their headquarters down from Champaign.
I get the need for that. I'm kind of sorry that it is, in fact, needed. You'd like to think that we were sufficiently ADA compliant everywhere, but how do they monetize it? How does an app like that make any money?
Yeah, so basically what you would do is you would sell this offering to local municipalities, right? So, you know, the benefit to these cities is that, like, hey, we've got a tool now that can, you know, greatly reduce, you know, the amount of time we spend doing something like this. And it helps, you know, cities save money too, right? So they're going to get access, you know, immediately to the areas that need to be fixed and able to move quickly and where they can reprioritize some other activities. So, yeah, you'd imagine that they're going to kind of sell this, you know, to municipalities who are going to use it as a big, big time saver and benefit to them as they're going about making sure everything is ADA compliant.
What's a Bloom Filter's story today?
Yeah, this is a startup, a software startup in Chicago. Yeah, they've raised $7 million earlier this month. Nice little early round of funding for these guys. They're a software firm that really kind of helps tech teams ship their software products. And so just helps to kind of identify different bottlenecks and help kind of ship different software. So very techie company, but I really like this interview that we had done with them because, you know, they raised their $7 million you know, in the middle of the Silicon Valley Bank failure and kind of just the tricky funding environment in general. And so I had a great interview with the CEO there who kind of talked about, you know, why it was so challenging and, you know, the process of having to talk to, you know, 150 venture capitalists. And I think that's, you know, to even just to raise a $7 million round. And I think that really goes to show you that, hey, you know, you see a funding round in the news or you hear about a company raising $7 million. It's a lot more work that goes into it than you think, right? When you have to have 150 pitch conversations just to get raise that kind of money. And so certainly things are different in 2023 than they were in 2021. Money a little trickier to come by, but not impossible. And, you know, venture capitalists are still, you know, valuing, you know, impressive tech businesses. And Bloom Filter, another, you know, Chicago-based business that was able to raise some good funding this year.
I see. Let's see. I've got a couple of other stories I want to get to here. But anything else that is on your radar that you want to make sure we touch on?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that, you know, of course, is you know, top line and so much tech coverage and analysis is artificial intelligence. We've got, you know, a big report coming out at ChicagoNO.com later today, really about kind of the state of artificial intelligence in the city. There's a lot going on, you know, nationally, and there's certainly some folks locally that are doing some interesting stuff as well. So, yeah, be sure to check out ChicagoNO.com. And AmericanNO.com, we also did a roundup of, you know, across the country, more than 35 companies in artificial intelligence that you should have your eye on. Many of those in generative AI, which we talk about a lot, which is the sort of, you know, ChatGPT type technology where you create an input And then it spits out a text for you, or like Midjourney, which will do images. And there's a lot of activity here. And, you know, we talk a lot about, the state of fundraising in startups in general. It's harder to raise money. That is not the case in AI. If you have an AI business, companies are raising big time venture capital right now. $100 million rounds are not out of the question for companies who are really plugged into artificial intelligence. So that's definitely an area that we're looking at across the country, but certainly in Chicago as well.
Saw some beautiful art over the weekend that was AI generated, and I don't know how I feel about that, but it was pretty to look at, but there was no artist behind it per se. So then how do we value that? And I wonder what the value of that is. Maybe a conversation for next week. Jim, good to talk to you. Thanks for doing what you do.
Thanks, John.
That's Jim Dahlke, national editor at American Inno. More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Electric vehicle maker Rivian, with a plant in downstate Normal, saw production and delivery drop in the first quarter. The company delivered 7,946 vehicles compared to 8,054 in the fourth quarter of 2022. Rivian reports quarterly earnings Tuesday and is expected to show a net loss. The company is expected to ramp up production moving forward while cutting costs. The net loss is blamed on factory downtime while upgrading its commercial van assembly line. Deerfield-based Baxter International is selling its biopharma solutions business to two private equity firms. Cranes reports the sale price is $4.2 billion in cash. The business unit provides manufacturing services for the pharmaceutical and biotech industries. The deal requires regulatory approval and could close in the second half of this year. Baxter's shares had been trading higher after the news broke. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and we're going back to the classroom today to learn more about farming practices that a lot of us non-farmers may have heard about, but don't really understand. After I tell you, we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Our ag teacher again today is
Chase Brown, a sixth-generation farmer just west of Decatur in Macon County.
Chase was kind enough to join us last week to educate us about no-till farming, which was trending after that I-55 dirt storm. He said no-till keeps the farmer's most precious asset, topsoil, from blowing away. Still, there are farmers who aren't buying into conservation farming. He is seeing a shift, though.
And I think the biggest reason for that is technology. Our equipment has gotten much better. The equipment can handle planting into those high residues. 20, 30 years ago, farmers would often see a yield drag by no-tilling. Well, with today's modern equipment, oftentimes, farmers can no-till and see little to no yield drag. And farmers are always concerned about yield because that's what pays the bills.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, what about cover crops?
And what that is planting a crop that we don't harvest in between our cash crops.
Things like
clovers, legumes, cereal rye, radishes to keep soil in place, hold moisture, maybe sequester some nutrients that were left over from the previous cash crops. And then when they die, it will release it back to the cash crop that's going to follow it.
Okay, another farming term we've heard about, strip till.
For a farmer that isn't ready to give up tillage but realizes the benefits of no-till, strip till is a nice blend of the two. And it makes a swath about 10 inches wide through the field, and it clears a path. So it's bare dirt for 10 inches. It makes a beautiful seed bed to plant into, and then it leaves residue between the next pass of 10 inches.
And now you know a little. For more, you can go to Facebook.
Brown Seed Sales is the best way to find me.
Okie doke. On our calendar, today is National Coconut Cream Pie Day, and in light of that accident last week and the ongoing need for blood donations, today is World Red Cross Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk about people's mental health and their money, Ted. What's the story here? What are you looking at?
We found that 52% of U.S. adults say that their mental health is negatively impacted by money. Last year, it was 42%. So we've seen a sizable jump just in this past year, and a lot of it tracks back to inflation. That, by far, is the biggest thing people say they're stressed about. You know, connected to that, of course, would be things like day-to-day expenses outpacing their paycheck and feeling like they don't have enough emergency savings. But a lot of it just tracks back to this cumulative toll of high inflation, I would say.
It's funny because, you know, I think the marker we've all been using is COVID. As soon as we get out of the pandemic, things and anxiety will be better. This is, as we get further away, getting worse.
It's interesting you bring that up because I actually think a lot of inflation is rooted in the pandemic, you know, namely in a lot of the supply chain disruptions and worker disruptions and shortages.
Stimulus
payments, you know, had part of that. Yeah, exactly. As well, I think we're still sort of coming out from that. We saw a big surge in good spending for a while in 2020 and 21, and more people were at home and they were renovating and buying furniture and electronics. And now this past year, year and a half, it's shifted more towards services and people crave experiences like travel and dining and concerts and sporting events and all that. I would argue that there are still a number of mismatches just between supply and demand and different industries. I mean, that's another thing. There's been sort of this rolling recession idea that different industries have kind of gone through challenges at different times. But, you know, I think bottom line, there are some strong fundamentals in the job market, but people are not feeling great about things because inflation is eating so much of their paycheck.
Are there other, how does that compete with other areas of stress or anxiety, challenges to our mental health? Did you just look at inflation and money, or are there other factors?
We asked about other things, too. Money was number one, and that actually outpaced things like your health and current events and relationships and other worries. So money is definitely very personal and very important to people. Specifically within the money category, the worries were really dominated by inflation and adjacent areas like day-to-day expenses and savings, you know, outpacing some of the longer-term worries like, will I have enough for retirement and things like that. It seems like people are much more squarely focused on the near term when it comes to their money.
Did you break it down demographically?
We did, yeah. Some really interesting factors there. Over the past year, the groups that have worsened the most, unfortunately, are women, Gen Xers, and lower earners. So whereas pretty much every group is feeling worse, sadly, now than they were a year ago, those three really stood out. There are other ways to slice it, too. Like inflation specifically is weighing the most on boomers, which you would expect, largely retirees that might be on a fixed income and their money's just not stretching as far. But young adults are not immune to this pressure either. I mean, a lot of young adults are also citing high day-to-day costs and just the fact that it's hard to afford rent and buying a house and raising kids and all these other things. So I think, like Fed Chair Jerome Powell has been fond of pointing out, inflation's a big deal because it affects everybody. And that's why the Fed's trying so hard to bring it down. And I think the progress has been a little slower than everybody would hope, but hopefully we're moving in the right direction because it affects everybody.
What's the current inflation rate?
Right now, we're coming in at 4.2% for the Fed's preferred gauge, which is core PCE. Interestingly, though, if you were to take out food and energy, it actually goes up, which is not usually the case. Usually we take those things out and it goes down. But I think it goes to show that right now inflation is pretty persistent, especially in the services area. It's definitely pretty ingrained in everything from rents to medical care and airline fares and, you know, all these things that people are spending on. I do think, you know, to be somewhat upbeat, I do think we're moving in the right direction. It's not going to be solved overnight. But I would give people advice that there are some things you can control at a household level. You can take on a side hustle. You can get a 0% balance transfer credit card. You can try to have money automatically transferred from every paycheck into a retirement and or savings account. You know, I think taking some of these steps will hopefully put you on the road to sleeping a bit better about your money.
Prioritize the necessities. Cut back on discretionary stuff is on your list. Build up your emergency savings. Easier said than done. But I think sometimes, tell me if you agree with this, they go, oh my God, an emergency amount of cash is a big pile of money I don't have. And so you don't even start. If you start and hang in there, it will happen, right?
Yep, absolutely. Slow and steady can win the race. I mean, that's definitely an important tenet of personal finance. And this won't be solved overnight. I mean, a lot of these things, they do take some time, whether that's, you know, saving for retirement, saving for a home, paying off debt, pretty much everything. But I would say that just starting to move in the right direction can help you to feel better. I think that's an important part of this, too, is that feel like you can take some of this power back and start moving in the right direction and build momentum, and that can help you out.
That's Ted Rossman, Senior Industry Analyst at Bankrate. Well done, Ted. Let's talk again. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Sounds good. I'll look forward to it. Thank you.